Dive into the Americas today with hosts Carl Meacham and Robert Funk for insights on U.S. Latin America relations and inter-American dynamics you won't find anywhere else. So Shannon, welcome. Welcome to the Americas today. We're really excited to have you. Folks, we're excited to host Shannon O'Neill, who's the author of The United States' Missed Opportunity in Latin America, where she sheds light on the pivotal yet unexplored role of Latin America and what role it could play actually in enhancing U.S. supply chains and national security amid the backdrop of global economic shifts and political volatility that we're seeing. I think most folks that are on or that are listening to our podcast know about the environment in which we are in the Middle East, Russia, Ukraine. So, you know, this is going to be a really exciting conversation to explore how shifting corporate risk perceptions in U.S. policy could redefine America's relationship with its southern neighbors for our mutual gain, right? First, let me just start with this. Did you watch the State of the Union last night?
Well, great to join you all. And I did indeed watch the State of the Union last night.
Yeah. I mean, no mention of Latin America. It's a missed opportunity.
It is indeed. It often is. You know, the only way it usually comes in is through migration, which we did hear a bit about last night. But really the, you know, 650 million people that live in countries to the south of the United States and all the kinds of things that I wrote about in my article and that we talk about in, you know, various policy conversations, those who talk about Latin America, none of that was on the table last night.
So how do you explain the missed opportunity? I think your article is really good, but, and it's also kind of hopeful in a way because it does lay out a path forward. But how would you explain it? Do you think there's a lack of capacity, a lack of will? Is there just too many issues on the table? Why do you think there isn't more attention being paid to the region?
A couple reasons here. You know, last night, many of the things where Latin America could benefit the United States, just to put it on that side of things to start, they were there in the speech, right? President Biden talked about U.S. economic competitiveness. He talked about creating jobs. He talked about creating, you know, secure supply chains, industrial policy, things like the CHIPS Act and Inflation Reduction Act, which is about the green transition. He talked about trying to change and sort of transform the U.S. economy to make it, you know, stronger, faster, more nimble, more national, more secure in a national security way. But he really talked about the domestic side of that, right? And that's partly the State of the Union. That's what they usually do. But he missed where I think the missed opportunity is. It's that you don't see, when you look for, you have your questions. How do we make the nation more secure? How do we make it more economically competitive? How do we have more jobs here in the United States? That the answer can't just be bring everything home, right? The answer has to be broader. And then when you do look broader, the Biden administration and administrations before it have often turned to other parts of the world. They've turned to Asia. We see that, you know, with the attraction to Asia and many countries there over the last 25 plus years, but more recently with the IPEF, the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework has been the big focus of the Commerce Secretary and the USTR and the like, trying to sign that agreement, or turns to Europe, thinking Europe is the solution to some of our commercial challenges and trying to de-risk from China. Let's turn to those others. And often we don't see a turn to Latin American nations. And Robert, as you say, you know, there's lots of reasons for this. Partly it's a lot of nations. It's not just one big nation you can turn to sort of solve your problem. Partly, you know, the normal kind of historical relationships with this region have focused much more on democracy. They've focused on drugs and sort of the challenges of security. They haven't really gotten into the economic side. And Latin America is a place where you've seen growth, economic growth, but not spectacular growth, right? So it hasn't been huge consumer markets that businesses have really focused on. So there's lots of reasons why it hasn't been at the forefront. But when we look at the way the United States is thinking about its global challenges and its economic challenges, this is a region that actually provides a lot of the solutions, whether it's critical minerals, whether it's free trade agreements for building out supply chains that won't be touching parts of Asia, whether it's sort of developing capacity and developing new markets for the United States and for the kinds of products we make here to export more to other places.
Yeah. So this has been a problem, Shannon, that has not specific to the Biden administration. I mean, we have complained through the years that, you know, not enough attention is given to the region. And there's always, you know, a context or variables from different administrations that define that, right? But as you've noted, do you think that it's just non-interest, a lack of political will? Or do you think that this is something that can be overcome with knowledge of the potential that exists there? Or is this sort of an institutional flaw that we have, that the U.S. focuses sort of on the front line issues and only deals with LATAM if there's some sort of crisis? How do you see sort of turning the lack of interest into, you know, at least some curiosity, and then sort of this full-fledged sort of opportunity seeking that you highlight in the article?
So I think it's some of that. I mean, part of it is we have seen a real shift in U.S. policy more broadly, and particularly what the definition of national security is, right? National security for many, many years was really defense, right? It was, you know, troops and planes and guns and bullets. And it still is that. We see that in, you know, Russia, Ukraine. We see that in other parts of the world. But it really has expanded in the last 5 or 10 years to be much more economic and even commercial, right? We want to know where our semiconductors are coming from. We want to know where our pharmaceuticals are coming from and whether we're going to have access to basic medicines in case, you know, there's a geopolitical conflict. We want to know where large capacity batteries, electric vehicle cars, green technology. We want to know where all this is coming from to make sure that if a geopolitical rival decided to shut things down, that we'd still have computers and cell phones and electricity grids and all the kinds of things that make our day-to-day work. And so with that bigger, broader definition, as we work that out, then the question is, okay, if we pick particular industries, particular sectors, which the United States has picked four particular sectors, if we pick those, how do we make sure at least part of those are quote unquote secure on national security grounds, that we can make them in places where we can trust those partners, either here in the United States and or with other nations? And so I think right now we're sort of redefining the way we think about that. And so there's a huge opportunity for Latin America to be part of that conversation, because it really hasn't in the past, but partly because we defined it differently. Now, in order for that to happen, though, it's not just on the United States changing a mindset or something. It's also in Latin America stepping up, right? And that, I think, is the other side of this equation, is the nations there, they have natural advantages. One is just geography. Lots of these countries are closer than many other countries. So logistics and time in terms of movement of goods or inputs and the like, as well as, you know, the cost of logistics can be lower. But it also, they also have free trade agreements. The United States doesn't have a lot of free trade agreements in the world, but most of them are in the Western Hemisphere. So there's a added advantage there, comparative advantage for companies that are going into many of the countries, about a dozen countries in the region. They can import, export without tariffs, with lots of other barriers that are lower than other places in the world. So that's a benefit. But many of these countries also need to do a lot on the ground to make it attractive for private sector companies to come in. Because one of the things for the United States versus, say, China, we don't have state-owned enterprises, right? We can't ask companies or encourage or force companies through geopolitical reasons to go and invest in particular places, right? Ford or GM or name your company, they have to make a profit for their shareholders and also to keep the lights on. So that, I think, is the big difference here. And so Latin America has a lot to do to make that environment more appealing and more attractive for companies that in the end need to make a profit.
I think that point is really, I think you kind of get at the heart of it, which is the difference in how China and the United States approach the region and the tools that they have to do so, right? China has state-owned enterprises. The United States has private sector enterprises. So their calculations are different in terms of how they're going to get involved in the region. But at the same time, the United States does have a national security. You know, you say that there's been a shift in national security, but there's also a national security aspect to, and you mentioned it in your article, a national security aspect to the kind of global competition for Latin America, whether it be Russia, Iran, China, or whoever can take up the space that in many ways the United States is giving up. Why is the United States not seeing that national security aspect to it, particularly in recent, you know, just in recent months, where we've seen, for example, visits of Russian diplomats and that sort of activity going on?
You know, I think they are seeing it to some extent. So you look at some of the industrial policy that's been put forward by the U.S. government, and there is space for Latin American nations, for instance, in the Inflation Reduction Act.
Right.
You see that the subsidies on the electric vehicle cars, if you're going to get that, you're a consumer, you want to go buy a car, you can get up to $7,500 of subsidies for your car if the critical minerals are mined and refined in a country that has a free trade agreement with the United States, i.e. Latin America, as well as some others, but mostly Latin America, or if it's manufactured and assembled in North America, so including Canada and Mexico. So there are some subsidies, right? But in the end, and as you know, Robert, as you point out, Chinese companies, especially state-owned companies, can go in and buy lithium mines or go in and make deals, and they don't need to be profitable. They may not need to be profitable for many, many years because there's other calculations that are happening there. And the Chinese government subsidizes them with loans, with other kinds of things, even as it at times directs them to go out and do certain types of policies. And the United States can't do that with its, right, its big, you know, companies. And, you know, it doesn't have these national champions. And there's good things to that, right? There's innovation and there's you know, making of markets and like, but it doesn't always work when there's a winner take all, when there's national security concerns on the table, when you have monopolies or oligopolies that can manipulate the price, they can drive out some of that private sector competition. So that is a challenge in general. But it's still, we do see when companies go into Latin America under many guises, you know, many of them are profitable. And we are seeing some movement, particularly in places like Mexico that already has a deep ecosystem of, you know, supply chains and various industries, whether it's auto or aerospace or processed foods or machinery. There's a lot of places there where they have ways for companies to be profitable. So you are seeing that. But the challenge, I think, is can we spread that more broadly around the region?
Yeah. So like you're seeing or hearing or the fashionable word or term now is nearshoring, friendshoring, trying to bring U.S. businesses back to the Western Hemisphere from China. When I hear that, it makes me sort of cringe in that, you know, if you're a free marketer, folks settle their businesses in places where it's profitable, where they can save money and they can make money. So reflecting on some of the challenges and opportunities, again, that you've highlighted and outlined in your article, are there policies that you would recommend for the U.S. to sort of lean into to foster a development of sort of the infrastructure and the necessary sort of variables in the region to make it more attractive and make it sort of beneficial for the U.S. and its market interests, but also for folks in the region, right? To create jobs, to make it more interesting, more lucrative for folks. I know it touches on a lot of the immigration side too, right? That if folks find a more attractive environment at home, they're less likely to pick up and go to the United States, for instance, or anywhere else. So are there policies that the U.S. government should be enacting that it's not to make it more attractive for us to be able to invest in Latin America?
So I think the single biggest shift of the last decade globally is that, you know, while as you laid out at the beginning of that, Carl, like, you know, markets drive things and it's your cost prices. I think the single biggest shift of the last decade is that governments increasingly are intervening on that price structure, on that cost structure. So they are changing the fundamental costs of where it is to do business. And sometimes they do this through tariffs, right? The Trump tariffs, now Biden tariffs, that changed the cost structure. Things that used to come into the United States from China are no longer profitable because of a tariff structure. They do it through hard breaks like export controls or the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act that, you know, questions and risks about whether you can actually import things. So that changes the cost structure and the risk structure for various things. So I think that part, sort of industrial policy, geopolitics, is actually changing company calculations in many ways and opening up opportunities for lots of other countries that didn't participate the last time around, that didn't have sort of the economies of scale and scope to be incredibly affordable like China did. And like really Asia as a whole did, where now it captures 50% of all manufacturing around the world. So there's a big opportunity here. Then the question is like, how do you take advantage of it? So one is the United States leaning into policies that make Latin America more affordable, more competitive, right? So some of the sticks against, you know, places like China, make China relatively more expensive than others. Other things like the pandemic that shows kind of the costs of logistics and distance and that have made places like Mexico especially, but other parts of Latin America more affordable as people look at their cost calculations and, you know, the cost of containers and the disruptions and the time cost of getting across the ocean that matters for more and more industries in the past. So some of that is a market-based thing. There are market-based things like demographics changing and you know, Latin America's demographics are not what they once were, but they're still not bad in terms of big workforces and the like, and sort of a long tail on that side. But the other side here, I think, is what Latin American nations need to do. And here, you know, what we have seen, especially when you look at industry for the 21st century, not the 20th century, is you need cheaper logistics. So you need better roads, rails, ports, airports, you know, storage around airports, all of that kind of stuff. So building that out so logistics costs less. I mean, you talk with CEOs, companies, and sure, labor matters, but actually logistics is often the biggest percentage of their overall cost. So if you can lower that, and Latin America's are high, especially vis-a-vis the United States, but vis-a-vis many places in Asia, including China. So if you can lower those costs, building physical infrastructure, that matters. Digital infrastructure matters increasingly more as services are a bigger part of all manufacturing as well as trade in general. So that's a big part as well. And then making it a place that you have, you know, the right education, right? The jobs of the 21st century are different than the jobs of the 20th century. So expanding on the educational basis that you have there, expanding on the middle classes and the kinds of things there, all of that stuff, you're seeing lots of nations, emerging markets and the like, of which Latin America falls within, making those steps. And I think that is really the main focus. So yes, there are subsidies, there are, you know, sticks and carrots the United States can do, but it's really laying the groundwork in these countries so that if you come, it's a good place to do business.
Yeah. And it just seems like the structure that we have for assistance sort of binds us to a certain type of assistance. And it looks as if what you're saying a little bit has to do with changing how that would happen. I mean, being able to provide infrastructure assistance would make a lot of sense, for instance. But I mean, it seems that we need to reform a little bit how we go about it so we can provide governments maybe with the support that they need to do the things that you're saying.
The other thing I would add in here is, you know, sometimes people lay out that, you know, it's hard to do business with the United States because the United States has the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. They have other kinds of, you know, transparency rules that say China, other places don't necessarily have to adhere to. But I think that can go both ways, where you talk with some governments in the region, especially some of the democratic ones, and they would rather do business with U.S. companies because they sort of know what they're going to get. They know, you know, it's not that U.S. companies have not behaved badly at various moments in the region. They have. But there are this sort of being held to account by U.S. courts, by other places. And sometimes lots of nations actually want that, right? They want the transparency that a U.S. structure and the like brings. And, you know, one where the United States has stepped in at various moments and I think has been helpful is, you know, when you put out a contract, you put out, you know, a bid for, you know, infrastructure, the like, U.S. with technical assistance, how do you write that so it's going to be more transparent? And so U.S. or European or other companies can actually put in a bid because they're not competing against those who might have sort of more opaque structures or ways of doing business. So I think there's ways there where it doesn't cost a lot of money from the United States, but it also can help governments who do want to expand the kinds of people bidding on these things, help them structure it in a way that, you know, U.S.-based construction companies can take part.
You know, I'm struck, Shannon, by what you say about Latin American countries having to do their part. And I think there's, you know, you made a list of, you know, things like logistics and corruption, other things, other problems that exist throughout the region. And certainly there's also an ideological aspect, right? You have new leaders who kind of, they say they're interested in doing business with the United States, but they also have this kind of non-aligned kind of approach towards trade and politics in general. But there's also the question of access to the United States market. You know, I mean, you mentioned the supply chain issue that was behind in many ways the change in U.S. policy, but there's also domestic politics, right? And there's an increased protectionism. There's a response to the Trump kind of movement. How easy is it or can it be for Latin American countries to kind of break that bubble and gain more access? You mentioned the IRA Act, but how easy can it be for Latin American countries to actually get in there?
Well, the good news for Latin America is a good part of Latin America, 11, 12 countries already have free trade agreements with the United States. And no other part of the world has as many free trade agreements with the United States, right? Europe does not have a free trade agreement with the United States. A couple of countries in Asia have free trade agreements, Korea, but you know, even Japan does not have an agreement with the United States. So you already have access. And you know, the US government right now is not one that looks keen to negotiate new free trade agreements. Whichever side of the aisle you're on, nobody really wants to make this, you know, the banner that they're gonna, you know, run for election or even spend a lot of their time when they're in office. So being already in that with the United States, I think is a built-in advantage, a comparative advantage that many countries have. Now for countries that don't have agreements like Brazil, so the biggest economy, like Argentina, also one of the big economies, it's going to be tricky, right? There might be spaces, for instance, of negotiating a, you know, critical minerals agreement where perhaps then you could supply, you could get within the IRA umbrella, but it's harder because you don't have a U.S. administration or a U.S. Congress that's particularly interested in negotiating free trade agreements. So overall, in terms of Latin America access, yes, they do have access, or many countries have access through that. You also have some efforts, particularly in the Biden administration, to build out some of these things with more logistical support, with more financial support, with more technical support through what they're calling the America's Partnership for Economic Prosperity, which has pieces from development banks and other parts that there's something there, right, for the sort of supply chains and the like. Probably not as much as needs, well, definitely not as much as needs to actually make this a big thing or really move it forward, but at least it's a start, right? It's a recognition of that. But, you know, I think when I look at U.S. policy over the years in Latin America and in other places in the world, but particularly for Latin America, the biggest initiatives that have come, whether that's, you know, NAFTA, which is now the USMCA, or some of these other things, they've actually come from Latin American countries and they've come from Latin American leaders and come to the United States. Now, then they get shaped and reformed. But it is, you know, the U.S. can often be pretty reactive. So I think if there are ideas out there, if there are countries out there that have big plans for the United States and access to the market, you know, it's worth coming with an agenda and then see if something can be made of it. 2024 is a little bit of a rough year to do this because guess what? As we found out last night in the State of the Union, we're in the middle of an election, but come 2025 with, you know, a new administration, a number two of somebody, you know, that's the time to sort of bring a plan and something that where we can move forward on these various issues.
Yeah, but I wanted to get to that exactly, Shannon, because I think that's the issue. And I want you to sort of try to predict a little bit. It used to be free trade agreements. The Dems would focus on labor and environment. The Republicans would focus on market access. Now, for some reason, it's become sort of both sides being anti-free trade agreements. And the difficulties associated with that. You mentioned APEP, which I think you're right, the way that you sort of framed it. It's a good sort of effort or in the direction of something positive. It's not codifiable. You can't get it ratified in the US Congress. Where do you see this sort of framework of trade moving? And the recommendations that you make in your article, which, you know, are great, and I think they're really necessary, but how likely and in what form do you think they can be implemented? And I know this is a hard question, but it, you know, what we've discussed begs the question of like, how can we see, or what would the likelihood be of us actually being able to see your recommendations implemented?
Well, this is, again, where Latin America has an advantage that lots of places in the world don't have, because you know what? The free trade agreement's already done. Yeah. You're not going to get free trade agreements with other parts of the world right now because of the complicated politics, you know, for good, yeah, for bad, for ugly. That's the reality. You are going to see these other sort of voluntary discussions and cooperation and things, you know, as we're seeing in Asia with various people, various countries there, as we see in the Americas. But given that you have a base there, then you can build on these aspects. You can build, you know, sector by sector ways of building out supply chains. You can focus on anti-corruption. You can focus on other kinds of monitoring. You can focus together on global standards to make sure that U.S. or Western Hemisphere based companies or those also in Europe, that the standards that they adopt for various kind of protocols are the ones rather than ones that come from elsewhere, where the U.S. and Western Hemisphere supply chains would have to be all redone to use those kinds of patents and the like. So there's all kinds of areas where I do think you don't need a free trade agreement that goes through Congress to make it, to have advantages, to make sure that investment comes in, to build out some of these supply chains. It helps to have free trade agreements. And that's where I actually see this comparative advantage of countries in the region, or many countries in the region, is that they already have gotten that part done. And now we're in a time where you're not going to see a lot more of that.
Well, Shannon, you know, two things come across, I think, from your article and also from this conversation, which gives us the opportunity to kind of dig a little bit deeper. One is, we're not just talking about trade. We're really talking about geopolitics. We're talking about the role of different powers in the world. We're talking about the role of Latin America in the world. And we're talking about domestic politics in the United States. And all of those things kind of mold what trade will look like in the coming years. And none of that is none of those issues are easy to deal with. And the second thing, which is a bit more positive, is because you provide those kind of policy recommendations, I think there's a glimmer of hope in your article as to the path forward. Hopefully, everybody will be reading your article as carefully as we did and taking those messages. Taking those messages home. So thank you so much for allowing us to delve deeper. It's been a real pleasure, and hopefully we'll have you again and continue the conversation.
It was great to join you. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, Shannon. You were awesome. Bye-bye. Thank you. Thank you for joining us for this episode of The Americas Today. In our next episode, we'll be back with Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado to discuss Venezuela's environment and economy. For now, we're signing off and wishing you a great day.